Hello and welcome to World Football on the BBC World Service. I'm Manny Jasmi. Coming up, we hear the rags-to-riches story of one of the world's best players.
My uncle Victor Hugo was around when I was playing as a kid. Because we didn't have enough food to eat at home, he gave me a helping hand and then took me to Colo-Colo. To this day, I'm in touch with him because he bought food for me so that I would be physically stronger and would grow because I was very thin.
And we remember the man they called Zapatones.
He became the man that changed Spanish football when he became a national manager. He achieved a huge thing for Spain. And not just that, also he created a unit within the country. And that's thanks to Luis Aragonés.
But first, I've travelled to De Toekomst, which is the training ground of the Dutch champions Ajax, to meet their coach and Holland's most capped outfield player, Frank de Boer. As a player, he won the Dutch title 5 times, the Spanish League once, the UEFA Cup and the European Champions League. He appeared in the World Cup semi-final and he missed 2 penalties in the Euro 2000 semi-final. But you take the rough with the smooth, don't you, Frank? Thanks very much for your time. When people mention Ajax, most people think of Cruyff, great young players, or Total Football. So how much pressure is there to continue developing great players in the style of Total Football?
Oh, I think it's a healthy pressure because, you know, we are used to it. And it's our lifeline also because we don't have the money that is in England or in Germany or in Spain. So we have to be depending on our youth academy because we cannot buy players from 26 years old for 10 or 15 million euros. So we have to be creative and that's why we put all our money on the youth academy. I left when I was 28. But now players already leaving when they're 23, 24. So we have to get even quicker young players ready to come in the first team. A few years ago, we lost that grip on it. But now we are more aggressive also in Europe to get also the youngest talented players to come for Ajax. Because they know they have the chance to develop better and also play in the Champions League and get chances to come in the first team.
You won the European Champions League here at Ajax with a very young team, of course. But do you think in the current climate, with the financial restrictions that you have when you compare to the big clubs, I mean, Manchester City, even after spending all the money they've spent, have never even got to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Yeah. So do you think it's now impossible for a club like Ajax to win the Champions League?
You always have to dream, and that's what we're going to do, because if you have a great mixture, but that's even also already difficult. You mentioned that our team was also quite young, but I was 25, my brother was 25, Van der Sar was 25. And that's just a nice age, you know, to just be 1 or 2 steps further than you were 21 or 22. And now the average age is 21 and a little bit more, and that's a hell of a difference. And we had, you know, like Rijkaard, Blind, who were, you know, the most experienced player. And now we have only 130-year-old player like Paulsen, and he doesn't play every game. So, but if we have still a chance to win the championship, yeah, everything has to fit at the right time. That you have like 6 unbelievable talented players, and you know, some mid-20 players who just stay for 1 or 2 years more. Then we have a chance to reach the semi-final and to win the Champions League. It's quite hard, but I'm still dreaming on it.
You've won the league in every season that you've been here, 3 years in a row. When do you think will come the time when you think, maybe I need another challenge, maybe I need to test myself in a new league?
Yeah, I'm not really thinking about that because I'm very happy right now at Ajax. My family is also important too. I have 3 daughters and a beautiful wife, so I'm not in a hurry to leave because everybody, you know, is still happy with me. Step in my car, you know, with a big smile to go to the Toekomst. So that's very important for me. I don't think I'm finished here, but it will come a time that I like it not anymore or the club doesn't like me anymore. So then we have to go both ways. Always depends, you know, what kind of perspective do you see, you know, for yourself or also for Ajax.
Is it right that you have politely declined interest, shall we say, from Tottenham and Liverpool?
Yeah, Yeah, especially Liverpool and of Tottenham called my manager, you know, is it a possibility, you know, after the sack of Villas Boas? And I said, no, right now it's not the right moment, you know, I'm middle in the league. So I'm very happy, you know, still here. But yeah, those two clubs, what you mentioned, are clubs what I think in the future I can be a manager of that, because I think the history of the clubs and what you can do with the team in the environment of those clubs, it's well my cup of tea, what I call it.
Well, you've already learned the English expression, yeah. So you're halfway there. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in the trend that's developed in Holland with so many players from the generation that you played in, the great players like yourself and Dennis Bergkamp, Patrick Kluivert, Jaap Stam, Philip Cocu, all of them have become coaches. And I just wonder why, because, you know, these are great players and they've, you know, well, I say they, you've all rolled up your sleeves, yeah, and gone into a completely new profession. Why do you think they've done it?
When you're playing in a good team, like in 98, for example, a lot of players that you mentioned are now in coaching or in football, but in that team, we had a lot of intelligent players. Not that intelligent that they are good in math or something like that, but they can read the game well. Like Philip Cocu, my brother, myself, Dennis Bergkamp. They were already two steps in front of the opponent because they were, yeah, now we call it in Holland gochme, football gochme. It's football intelligent. And yeah, that you cannot learn. And I think that's normally also skills for a manager, you know, to see what's already happening, not only in the field, but also outside the field. When I was 28 or something, they asked me, do you want to be a manager? I said, 100% not. But later, you know, when you get mature, like 32, you come involved with some coaches when you think, hey, I should do totally different. Or you get a manager who's so bad, you think, if he can do that at a club like that, then I have to can be also a coach.
In contrast to your going from the youth team up, one of your former teammates, Clarence Seedorf, has jumped in, yeah, at the very deep end. He's now the coach of AC Milan. What do you make of that?
Yeah, but Clarence is a little bit different to all other players. He was, you know, we call him when he was 16 and he came into the first team in the squad. We called him directly already a grandfather. So he was always curious, you know, want to know things. And when I was his age, you know, if somebody say yes, it's no. But he was also, but, you know, it's all my, he was always not black or white or more gray. And so he was always eager, you know, to learn also. And he knows exactly what he is doing, and he did it also when he went to Brazil, you know, to Botafogo, and I think he's ready. He has played so much on a high level. I think he's the player who won the most Champions Leagues in Holland. So for me, it's not a surprise that he directly take that step.
But it's a gamble, isn't it?
No, it's a gamble, not for him. Because, yeah, he can only learn from it. But it's more a gamble for the club Milan. And he has to bring a very experienced assistant coach with him that he knows his way, you know, how the jungle of football is.
That's the Ajax coach Frank de Boer, and we'll be hearing more from Frank next week when he defends Holland's physical style at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. You're listening to World Football on the BBC World Service with me, Manny Jasmi. Now, he may have retired last year, but he's still box office.
We want to create a stadium, we want to create a soccer team, a football club that is the people's football club. It's simple as that. You know, I've worked for some of the biggest clubs in the world with some of the greatest players in the world. I know there was a team here 10 years ago, and unfortunately they folded. But I think going forward, I wanted to create a team that can be very personal. I want to make it my own team. It's
some soccer fans in Miami thanking David Beckham for his plans to start a new Major League Soccer club in the city. The former Manchester United and Real Madrid player has exercised a $25 million option, which was part of his LA Galaxy contract when he moved there in 2007, and allows him to own a club at a hugely discounted price. But his announcement merely marks the start of a lengthy process which will require his group to find a stadium location and financing before getting approval to create the league's 22nd club. But how easy will it be for Beckham to make a success of it in a city like Miami, which, as he mentioned, has had a football club before? The Miami Fusion were dissolved in 2001 as part of a cost-cutting measure by MLS. The club's chairman was Ken Horowitz, and he's been telling me about the experience.
It was a very, very expensive undertaking, and it was 90% of my personal time, as well as a lot of executives that worked for me.
And why did you do it?
I love soccer. I've always been a soccer nut. I think it's the greatest sport in the world. I continue to believe and have seen it exploded in this country in the last 15 years or so. And I thought that it would be important that there be a team here in South Florida.
But why isn't there a team in South Florida anymore? What happened?
We really had disappointing attendance, both the Miami Fusion as well as the Tampa team. And it was a mutual decision with me and the league to close Miami, and it made sense to close Tampa. And when I say close Miami, the team was based in Fort Lauderdale.
What were those poor attendances down to, do you think, in your opinion?
I can come up with a lot of reasons. I think we should have been in Miami to begin with. The political climate back then was very poor. We had really no cooperation from Miami. In fact, the mayor was outright almost hostile against having a team. We had a very difficult time doing a deal that made sense for us at the Orange Bowl. And it caused us to have to look elsewhere. And literally, inside of 5 months, I built a soccer stadium in Fort Lauderdale. I think it was 22,000 seats. Our team was the first game on ABC Sports that year. So I had a deadline I had to make, and we couldn't do a deal in Miami, so we moved to Fort Lauderdale.
But Florida has a very large Hispanic community who have a great traditional soccer heritage from the various countries that they come from and their parents come from. So it's quite surprising that you couldn't attract them to come and watch your team.
I was flabbergasted. We sold out the first game. There were cars lined up on I-95, literally for miles. We had to turn people away. The second game almost sold out, and then it just deteriorated from that. I think some of it, and I've said this before, was it was an open stadium, and in South Florida, literally at that time of the evening, it was very humid, it was raining.
How big a factor do you think is it that the people of the area, the locals, maybe prefer to watch other leagues or have allegiances to clubs in countries where they're originally from?
That was a very big factor. There's no doubt about it. Often when we had games, there were soccer games going on overseas, and people were watching that on cable, satellite, or however they could get it in local bars. We were aware of that. But MLS as a league and the quality of play, is really, what is it, 13 years already since we've closed the team, it's changed immensely.
So the quality of the league has changed and become more attractive. Brand Beckham will always draw them in, but you can't control the weather, and MLS is still
played in the summer. Well, you can control the weather with the right stadium.
So what kind of stadium do you think David Beckham should build?
Certainly stadium with overhang to shelter the fans from rain.
And can he make a success of it, do you think? Is the market there?
It is. Miami has really changed in the last 13 years. I go down there all the time. It's about an hour and 20-minute drive for me. It's become vibrant. The quality of life has improved there. I really do believe Miami has changed tremendously for the better.
And what do you think of Beckham's very ambitious strategy of attracting some of the world's best players to come and play in Miami?
If anybody can do it, he can. Miami is a place where people want to begin with. And Beckham probably has a very, very fat Rolodex. and believe me, at the right moment. I attended the VIP party the other night, Tuesday night, and chatted with him for a while. He knows who to call. And there are going to be people that want to play in a Beckham-owned team.
You've been there, you've worn the T-shirt, and you've given up the T-shirt, I suppose, we can say. What advice did you give to David Beckham when you spoke to him?
I'm not going to be specific, but I gave him a lot of information, and not just him, but his team, in terms of things that worked for us and didn't work. And I'm going to continue to do that. I really want to help make this a huge success. It's important to me to see soccer here.
He says that he doesn't want to use any public money. It's all going to be financed by his group. Is that realistic?
I believe he can pull it off, yeah. There are a lot of people that want to invest in this team.
And now that the Beckham ball has started to roll, what impression have you been left with by the events of this week?
Very positive. It's a very different political climate. I spoke with many of the commissioner's politicians at that VIP party Tuesday night, and where I felt some hostility back in 1996, 97, when we were planning the team, which caused me literally to go to Fort Lauderdale and build the stadium, something that I really wasn't planning on. The picture is very different this year. It's night and day. They clearly want to see a team in Miami.
Is there a bit of you which thinks, I wish I was involved in this again?
Absolutely. More than a bit of me. I'd like to be involved.
Do you think you will be, maybe?
I might very well. There's been discussions.
The chairman of the former MLS club Miami Fusion, Ken Horowitz. Now, the 20th World Cup kicks off in 4 months and 6 days' time in Brazil. The first tournament on South American soil for 36 years will feature a record number of South American teams, 6 to be precise. One of the most exciting will be Chile, and here's why. In qualifying, they scored the second highest amount of goals, 29, but conceded 25. And they couldn't have been given a much tougher group. They'll face both the finalists from 2010, Spain and Holland, as well as Australia. Alexis Sanchez of Barcelona will be the star on whom most people will focus, but the Juventus midfielder Arturo Vidal will be arguably their most influential player. The 26-year-old, who signed from Germany's Bayer Leverkusen in 2011, has emerged as one of the world's best all-round midfielders. And before the World Cup, he'll be trying to win a third Italian league with Juve. He's been speaking to World Football's Adnan Nawaz about his early life, when he looked after his 5 siblings, whilst his mother strove to put food on the table.
It was difficult. My family life was a bit complicated because of my mother's situation. Money was scarce, so it was very tough. But when I got into football, things slowly started to get better.
Did you realize that football could be the way to a better life very quickly?
Yes, of course. It was something I really wanted, to improve my life, the life of my brother, of my family, but it was also a dream. As a kid, I loved playing football, and I always thought I wanted to become a professional. My uncle Victor Hugo was around when I was playing as a kid. Because we didn't have enough food to eat at home, he gave me a helping hand and then took me to Colo-Colo, and I started playing there. To this day, I'm in touch with him because of everything he did for me, and because he bought food for me so that I would be physically stronger and would grow, because I was very thin.
You were still very young when you went to Bayer Leverkusen. Was that a big shock for you?
In Chile, the football is very different. It's a lot more easygoing. It's not so physical. It just was impossible to compare that to what it was like in Germany, because the players were so much bigger and so much faster. Germany has very good technical players, so for the first few weeks, that really cost me. And then there was the language, and actually that was the biggest challenge I ever had in Germany, but I quickly adapted.
You are quite possibly the best player in your position in the world. Bloomberg Sports List, for example, at the end of last season, had a list of the world's top players. You were number 11 overall in the list. But in terms of your position, you were the best player. Do you think about that? Do you realize?
It's incredible. I think that if it really is the case, I'm very happy. But I've worked really hard to be in the position those lists put me in. But yes, I feel I'm an important player in a role which requires you to attack and defend. But I've also got very good teammates who help me play well in my position.
Do you feel the great history of this club, Juventus, which has won more than any other Italian club ever.
Yes, you can really feel it. The passion of the fans is incredible. To wear the shirt of Juventus is the most beautiful thing that's happened to me. And when you enter the field of play, you realize what's at stake and what's expected of you.
The Chilean national team has a very particular style of play. When you guys were at the 2010 World Cup with Marcelo Bielsa as your coach, you gained so many followers all over the world because you were so exciting to watch. The style of play was almost kamikaze.
Yes, he did really well, but now the team that's going to Brazil is twice as good, twice as strong, twice as intense. Bielsa and our current coach, Jorge Sampaoli, work in similar ways. But Sampaoli is a bit different in how he manages the group. But I think all the players from 2010 have matured a lot, and we're a better team that plays better football.
Okay, so who's in your World Cup group? Can you name the teams?
The champions and the runners-up of the last World Cup. But as I said, in the 2010 tournament, we left a good image of ourselves, and I think it's going to be a lot better this time. We know we have to win one of those two games because we want to get to the next stage, but we have to try to win all three games, or at the very minimum, leave everything we have out on the pitch.
Do you think about football? Do you analyze it when you're not playing in a match?
No. I analyze it because I think it's important to watch games afterwards to see which details can be improved.
Okay, so that means you only live for football?
For football and for my family, of course.
Football with a smile, from the Juventus and Chile midfielder Arturo Vidal, speaking with World Football's Adnan Nawaz. Finally this week, on Saturday, Spain, and especially fans of Atletico Madrid, mourned the death of the former Atletico and national team coach Luis Aragonés at the age of 75. He'd been battling leukemia. Known as Tapatones, or Big Boots, Aragonés won three titles and two cups as a player with Atletico, and a league title and three cups in four spells spanning 30 years as the club's manager. He also coached Barcelona, Espanyol, Valencia, Real Betis, Sevilla, Real Oviedo, Mallorca and Fenerbahce in Turkey. In all, he took charge of 791 top division matches in Spain, a record. Oh, and he was also in charge of Spain when they won Euro 2008, their first title for 44 years. The former Spain international, Gaizka Mendieta, worked with Aragonés at Valencia in the mid-1990s.
He obviously liked his teams to work hard, because the way he used to play, it was a very demanding physical tactics. And I remember the first or the second day of the pre-season, Romario, obviously not a football player that will enjoy running much off the pitch. And I think you might remember that these images of Luis Aragonés talking to Romario, saying, you know, look into my face. He tried to convince him that that was the way for him to play football. And if he didn't fit into that style, he wouldn't be able to stay in the team. And we're talking here about Romario back in the days when it was, I don't know, like the likes of Ronaldo or Messi nowadays. And he didn't stay for long, unfortunately, and because Romario wasn't the type of player that would fit into Luis Aragonés' philosophy or football understanding.
So how big a figure was he in the Spanish game?
He was known for someone that it would stick for the players, that would obviously would follow his philosophy, or more than follow, we would believe in the way he understood football. He became the man that changed Spanish football when he became a national manager. In those days, again, with Raúl as the main man for the national team, he decided that Raúl wasn't at the level that he should be to play in the national team. And he put all his efforts to make of Villa the main striker for the national team. I remember the days, a lot of arguments and a lot of papers and radios and TV, how Luis Aragonés could plan the national team without Raúl. And so he did. He gave the direction of the team to Xavi, which back then wasn't even regular in the Barcelona team. You can imagine that, Xavi not being regular, but he wasn't. And he changed the whole philosophy of the national team. And Luis Aragonés started to play in tiki-taka sort of football that we used to watch now.
Gaizka, how important to the nation was winning the European Championship in 2008? It was Spain's first title for 44 years.
Absolutely. It was huge because Spain until then, we always had the players, we always had the sort of quality, always were considered the favorites to win it, but we never did. For that moment on, Spain, the fans, the country, the players, we all believed that it was possible, and that only was because we won it, because we broke that curse about quarterfinals that Spain had in every single tournament that it took part in. Every time we reached quarterfinals, we were out.
And for the rest of your life, whenever you hear the name Luis Aragonés, what will be the image or the memory that will come into your mind?
I'm curious now, the luck to have him as my manager, that good experience to be under someone that he know or knew so much about football. And then someone absolutely that he changed the way Spanish see the national team, because that created a unit also within the country, and that's thanks to Luis Aragonés.
And how fitting a tribute would it be if Atletico Madrid win the title this season?
Well, it would be huge for Luis Aragonés if he's seen us from up there, and for his family, because he managed so many clubs, but Atletico Madrid was definitely the club that I think it was in his heart, because the time he spent there was always special for him. And if Atletico Madrid managed to do that, it would be, I'm sure there'll be memories and moments of reflection for Luis Aragonés if Atletico Madrid wins something at the end of the season.
The former Spain and Valencia winger Gaizka Mendieta remembering Luis Aragonés, who died on Saturday, and Atletico gave him a perfect tribute on Saturday when they went top of the league for the first time for 18 years. That's all for this week. Remember, if you want to download World Football, just go to our website. That's bbcworldservice.com/worldfootball. And you can also follow us on Twitter at @WSWorldFootball. Do join me and Shari Val for Sports Hour on Saturday at 10 o'clock GMT. But if you can't, until next week, always remember, World Service, World Football.